Right. Good morning, everybody, and welcome. My name is Jack Watkins. I'm part of the policy team at the Institute of Welsh Affairs. I'm going to be chairing today's Rethinking Wales event, Social Care After COVID-19. So just to start, a couple of housekeeping issues. On Zoom, participants are going to be muted by the host, and we're going to be using the Q&A section for questions. So if you'd like to direct questions to any particular panelist, please state their name in the question. We'd also encourage you to engage with each other in the chat, so we have a separate chat window as well as the Q&A. Please remember as well that all the chat and questions are recorded, and the event, the video is being recorded as well. We'll be sharing it on our YouTube channel later. We'll also be keeping strictly to an hour, but keeping the chat room open a little bit so you can continue to connect with each other as well. So after a break over the summer, we're resuming our Rethinking Wales series of online discussions. We'd like to extend a huge thank you to Carnegie UK Trust for their generous support in funding these events. The sessions are an opportunity to pause and reflect on the lessons we're all learning during the COVID-19 pandemic. In previous sessions, we've discussed the impacts of COVID-19 on the Welsh economy, on towns in Wales, on higher education. And we've also looked at how some of the impacts have differed for children and young people and for women. Today, we're going to be looking at a sector that is right at the heart of the response to COVID-19. Alongside the NHS, social care providers have worked tirelessly, making tremendous sacrifices in order to provide essential care and support to those who need it. Workers have had to adapt, find new ways of reaching people, whilst quickly incorporating PPE and social distancing into their day-to-day work. It's not just the individuals they support who feel the benefits. Sector provides well-needed respite for family members, and we all owe a huge debt of gratitude to carers, something the public have demonstrated loud and clear on the doorstep. But the sad fact is that applause is not going to be enough to put social care where it needs to be. Well before COVID-19, sector was already facing structural problems that are only going to get worse with time. An aging population means new and complex demands are rising at a time when the workforce is shrinking. There are long-standing issues of pay and conditions that are making some difficulties in recruiting and retaining the skilled people needed. Concerns are consistently raised about how care could potentially be better joined up with health, both for funding and administration purposes. Fixing all of these problems takes money, and paying for care remains highly controversial. Neither self-funding nor higher taxes are particularly popular, but it's looking increasingly likely that governments in the future are going to have to find a mix of both. With all this in mind, we'd like to see social care put front and centre in party manifestos for the upcoming Welsh Parliament elections. It's not enough to simply recognise the problems. Politicians need to set out detailed plans and be prepared to make difficult choices. We also believe that ultimately the best solutions are going to come from people on the ground. That's why for today's discussion, we've got an audience that represents the diversity of the sector, with providers from statutory and voluntary sectors and from wider civil society organisations. That diversity is also reflected in our panel today, who I'll introduce before we get started. Maria Bell is Head of Policy at the National Commissioning Board for Social Care at the Welsh Local Government Association. Adrian Roper is Chief Executive of Catrefi Cymru, a charitable cooperative providing support for people with learning disabilities. Glyn Williams is the owner of the Gwyddfawr Care Home in Anglesey. And Rachel Williams is a senior family worker as part of Flying Start in Anglesey and is also an ambassador for Social Care Wales's We Care campaign to promote recruitment. Thank you all very much for taking the time to be with us today. So getting started then, I'd like to ask a couple of questions really just about the direct experience of COVID-19. So starting with Maria, what do you think some of the key lessons have been for social care?
I think a lot of the reflection has been about just how positive, I mean, you mentioned the role of the workforce in terms of their response, their flexibility, their innovation, their creativity. And what's been really important is shining the light on the social care workforce. Very few people really know or understand what the role of a social care worker is. And we have a joint NHS or health and social care workforce strategy that suggest that probably the social care roles are less valued than the NHS. So it's been really great to shine a light on the importance of social care services. I think that there's been an awful lot more collaboration across community services, the independent sector, health and local authority services. There's an awful lot of lessons to be learned about the benefits of that in that closer working together, having the needs of the citizen at the centre. I think there's also been, you know, we've realised how different Wales can be from the other nations, and just how fortunate we are in an awful lot of our small, very local, grown social care services, and the importance of that, and just how resilient that can make us in the you know, in the face of such a pandemic. I think we've looked at things like infection prevention and control and the importance of personal protective equipment in that. And one of the real positives that we've got from this is a really clear arrangement now for the provision of PPE to the social care sector, purchased through the NHS Shared Services Partnership, delivered through joint equipment stores. So the importance of some of those national infrastructures and local delivery. So there's been an awful lot there, really. So it's really what can be achieved by that collaboration. So we have a policy directive around a healthier Wales looking at seamless services. So the art of the possible has been really interesting. Some things that may have seemed quite difficult in the past have become very possible and really very important as part of the pandemic. So a huge lot, and I think better relationships across different parts of the system, and a greater understanding of one another's role and how we can all bring our collective talents and resources to make a real difference for people. So there's an awful lot there. And just today, you know, the importance of the digital platform and technology. And how that can really give us significant opportunities in the future to do things differently. So we worry an awful lot about the money that we don't have, and it's given us opportunities to look at how we use the funding and resources that we do have better. So a huge amount, really. I mean, it's very difficult to capture it in a couple of minutes.
I mean, it's very broad. There's obviously a great deal of diversity in what different people are doing within the sector, and you've touched on an awful lot there. Rachel, if I could come to you. I know you work with Flying Start, and that typically will involve a lot of face-to-face work with children and parents. It'd be good to hear about what are some of the changes that you've had to make in your work, and also whether you think any of those changes are actually going to become permanent.
Yeah, well, we've had to make a lot of changes because obviously we're not allowed to do our face-to-face visits at the moment. So it was quickly having to change and think, how can we still reach these parents that need our support? So we started doing sessions on Teams and doing our Facebook page. We look more into that, of how can we reach them on Facebook and support. But that's opened it wider for us, that we feel that we're reaching more of our families because it's more open. Whereas before, it was a timed session in one place, whereas now, you know, anybody over, you know, within the Flying Start area on Anglesey can come on any time and join together, which has been really good for that. And we've been doing evening courses now, because obviously during the pandemic and lockdown that children were home, so it was more difficult. So we opened it up that parents could have the support in the evening when their children were were in bed and able to have time with us. So, and that's definitely something that we're going to be carrying on doing, because, you know, we found that it has wider, you know, really to reach more people and families. And again, as Maria said, really, meetings has been a lot more accessible, getting people together, you know, with meetings, because you're cutting down on the traveling and because that takes a lot of some people's time. So it's been a lot more accessible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that probably a lot of us working in, yes, not in social care can recognise, yeah, as well, that, you know, there's definitely been benefits to doing this kind of, you know, online meetings and things like that. Yeah. Glyn, your work is as part of a care home, and it's probably a lot more difficult for you to provide what you provide over Zoom, I imagine. As a director of a care home, you've obviously had to be working very hard to make huge changes in what you're doing. You've also had to work very closely with other public bodies, so Public Health Wales, Betsy Goodwater Health Board, local authorities. I'd be really interested to know, you know, how those relationships have been, and have you got everything that you've needed from them?
Well, firstly, I should explain that I also sit on the Care Forum Wales Council. And as such, I'm in touch with care providers across the whole of Wales on a daily basis via the Care Forum Wales WhatsApp group. Now, this group has without doubt been our biggest weapon in the fight against COVID. We've shared experiences, we've shared research, learned from each other throughout the whole of the pandemic. At the beginning, Care Forum Wales launched the Shield Social Care and Save Lives campaign. And that alone, I think, has certainly focused everybody's efforts into saving the social care sector. But going back to your question, really, the short answer is no. We haven't received everything we need. I don't think we ever would. At the beginning of the pandemic, providers were struggling to source PPE, trying to work safely with inadequate guidance, no testing, and limited financial resources. But despite these challenges, they threw everything into protecting their residents. Care home providers and managers really know only too well what it's like to control an unwanted infection when it gets into a home. Our managers and staff are very experienced with norovirus, flu, and even the common cold. But we all knew that COVID was something completely different, simply because we'd read the evidence in the medical journals in February about asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic transmission. We should also remember that these big organisations like NHS, Public Health Wales, local authorities, and even the Welsh Government, that they have the luxury of shared responsibility and shared accountability when it comes to the well-being and the safety of the people they're responsible for. But in a small family-run care home, which is what the majority of them are in Wales, all that responsibility falls onto the shoulders of one person or a couple, the owners and managers. Care home residents are not just residents or patients to these people. They're their extended families. The stress that these guys are under is akin to something you'd expect on the front line of a war zone, to be honest with you. I mean, I've talked to some managers and owners who have had some terrible losses during the first peak. And it reminded me of the old PTSD training videos that we used to have to watch in the forces in order to recognise the signs in their colleagues. Things are better now, no doubt about that. We've had a lot of help, but we are still struggling with certain issues. PPE issues, we're still struggling, certain ones. Adequate guidance, we're struggling with that, especially around visiting. Help with self-funders, extra COVID costs. Inadequate or inaccurate testing is a massive factor, and really testing is the solution to this. Lack of financial resources are still a problem, especially to provide safe visiting facilities going into the winter. We've had some fantastic ideas coming forward to improve the mental health of our residents on visiting, but they're very expensive. We do need help with that. And one of the biggies is a lack of insurance. I mean, most insurance providers now have implemented a no COVID risks policy. The NHS in England are protected by a government-backed indemnity. We don't have that luxury, so that's always in the back of our minds. The local authority, yeah, generally very helpful. My only comment would be that they're too focused on trying to operate within their budgets, to be honest, which you can understand. The health board, very helpful, but finding the right person to talk to can be a challenge. The fast track testing that they've set up is incredibly helpful, but it still doesn't operate fast enough. Public Health Wales, once again, generally helpful. They're obviously very intelligent people. They understand the science, but I do feel that they're sometimes out of touch with the real world.
What really comes across is, you know, the huge changes that were made and the huge impacts that this had. And it's worth reflecting on the fact that it's not over. You know, this isn't something that's done. And we've all been following the news. We're potentially approaching a kind of second peak, a second national lockdown. But Adrian, if I could ask, sort of imagining a time when COVID is more under control, whether that's because of testing, whether that's because of vaccines, do you think that the care sector should be aiming for a return to normal, kind of what was going on in, you know, beginning of this year? Or do you think that really there are kind of bigger changes it could be making to contribute more towards people's well-being, people's independence?
A couple of things that we don't want to go back to, I think, is a very fragmented and confrontational set of relationships within the sector. So I was great to hear Glyn talking about that Pan Wales Social Care Forum. Care Forum Wales WhatsApp. I also think it's been brilliant during the pandemic that Care Forum Wales has been working closely with Cymorth Cymru, representing housing-related care and support, and the Wales Council for Voluntary Action. And if you like, all of that range of provider umbrella bodies has been working on a weekly basis with Welsh Local Government Association and Welsh Government to see through, you know, the COVID challenges. I think my reflection is, you know, every week is always a challenge in social care, and we should not stop doing those, having those collaborative meetings at the highest level and making things better just because the virus has gone away. I think it's been a great example of something good happening. I think if it doesn't sound too mercenary and flippant, I think it's been absolutely brilliant that local authorities have actually paid up right at the start of the financial year the amounts required to pay, you know, wage uplifts and so on, because, you know, in previous years, some of us have had to wait well into the year to get the funding to cover a statutory pay uplift requirement. This time, with COVID breathing down our necks and everybody realising how important care is, the money's come through quickly. And so I think, again, that sort of more responsive, financially friendly relationship between funders and care providers would be great to see contained. In terms of you know, future developments and not going back to the new normal, I guess I would say, you know, we were already on a journey in Wales to transform social care, to use a bit of a jargon. I mean, we've got the Social Services and Wellbeing Act and the Future Generations Act, which are both brilliant pieces of legislation, wanting to see public services, and in particularly the one in terms of social care, based on clear principles, you know, principles whereby the support provider and commissioner are having a real meaningful conversation as equals with the people receiving the service, and those services are shaped by that dialogue. There's a principle about prevention, you know, that you don't just sort of keep pouring money into dealing with crises, but actually you step back and see where could we invest backstream, as it were, of the crisis in order to prevent that happening or becoming so bad. And some aspects of the care system, you know, are not designed to reinforce or incentivize the promotion of people's independence. It's almost in the provider's interest to keep them dependent so that they keep getting the hours and they keep getting the money. Well, this is silly. So we need to shift the system into being more preventative. And you know, the prevention agenda also sort of inevitably takes you in the direction about talking about unpaid assets, you know, about families and friends and neighbours. And we've seen great examples of the community stepping up in COVID, that actually we need to find a way in which the social care system is encouraging more and more community self-help activity rather than just only focusing on, you know, we've got a crisis, we've got to pay for it, someone's needs are off the scale, so they get the service. Well, you know, let's be clever, and we've got the legislation as the platform to do that.
It's really interesting that those, you know, some of those pieces of legislation have really set a bit of a direction of travel, and obviously COVID has come along and in some ways thrown a little bit of a spanner in the works. But it is interesting to hear all of you mention that there are some positive lessons coming out of that. One thing I wanted to pick up on is about the perception, the wider perception of the sector, and particularly the workforce as well. So Rachel, you're involved with the We Care campaign, which is about promoting care work to people across Wales. You will go out and you will talk to people and try and, you know, find what their interests are and encourage them to look at care as a career path. What do you think are some of the reasons people might be put off care work?
What we do find is that they find that it's a non-academic route. You know, it's like if you're not academic in school, it'd be, you know, down the childcare route or, you know. But my part of my role as an ambassador is to say that, you know, you need to be one of the most highly skilled and trained people to work in the care sector. You know, you're looking after people's most precious people, you know, either their children or their members of their families in care homes, you know. So there needs to be, I mean, there's so much policies that they need to follow and everything. So that's part of my job, is to do that, to, you know, explain that to them as well, you know, that it's not just, you're not academic and that. So, and I think the perspective of the role, isn't it? Yes. You know, if you go into the social care, social workers, it's there to, you know, split families up and things like that. But it's not, they don't see how it's, you're there to help as well. And I think, you know, it's the low paid sometimes, you know, you know, that does put some of the young people off as well. And some lack sometimes of high quality work experience as well.
Right.
To look into that. And for, as an ambassador, what we speak to students, you know, it's getting them the right quality of work experience for them, so that they are able to have a fully work, you know, full work experience, so they can see the full role on the job. But that is quite a lot of barrier. It is, you know, thinking of it's I'm not realizing that how much they can learn in the role and become really, really highly skilled, which they need to be in the care sector. You know, it's just a route to go because you're not academic.
No, and I feel like that's something that has really come front and centre into public opinion, really, is, yes, realising through, yeah, COVID-19 is,
yeah,
actually these are people who are having to adapt and to innovate and to come up with new ways of doing things and to completely, yeah, change their way of working,
yeah,
on the fly. Very, very highly skilled,
yeah,
even if it's not necessarily things that are typically part of the qualification system. These are skills that people need to be able to do the job. You sort of mentioned about pay there, and it's come up as well in a couple of your responses. I'd like to ask Maria, Do you think that more money would solve the problems in the social care sector? Are there other things, that other reforms that need to go alongside that?
I think there's certainly a need for investment in social care, and for more funding and investment in social care, but I don't think it's the only thing that we need to do. Clearly, there is a need to invest in workers' paying conditions. You know, people need enough money to live a good life. We know that there are, you know, a large number of work, social care workers that have to claim benefits and housing tax, housing benefit support and various things like that. And I think there's almost a, you know, an assumption or a link around the esteem, you know, because something's low paid, it might be seen as of low value. And as Rachel and Glyn and Adrian have all shown just how utterly valuable our workers are, the compassion, the skills that they have. So there's absolutely a need for investment in workforce terms and conditions. But also, you know, we started to see the power of the digital and technology system. But there's an infrastructure there, isn't there? You know, so there's an awful lot that we can do now through seeing our GPs, you know, over a video screen. That's appropriate in some circumstances, but not others. But still, you know, in preparation for today, we had to talk about what do we do if the broadband goes down. You know, so the big areas of our country that don't have that infrastructure. So there's absolutely a need to look at, you know, if we're looking at technology enabled workforce, then we need to make sure that the infrastructure is there for that. But also in things like some of the buildings providing our accommodation with care. You know, the CIW study into looking at the condition of a number of our care homes showed that, you know, so many of them are 40, 50 years old, they're converted old rectories and things. We need some capital investment from that, and we need to look at whether that, you know, we have an awful lot of providers in the private sector. Banks are concerned about the risks there, so we need to look at, you know, the availability of loans or capital to support some of that. And we've seen the importance of environment on such as the spread of infection, you know, the ability to create small staffed units in larger accommodation to try and reduce some of that. So we absolutely need, you know, additional funding investment, but it isn't the only thing. You know, we do need to understand and evidence the real cost of care, and make sure that's taken account of in funding, you know, provided to local authorities and health boards to be able to then set the budgets to pay that right cost of care for commissioned care services. But also we need to look at that joint working across the system, the duplication that we might have, some of the waste that we have. There's a real evidence base that working more closely together, as Adrian's mentioned, that co-production, we get things right first time rather than investing in something that we then have to change later on down the line because possibly we didn't co-produce it well enough in the first place. So I think that there are areas of waste that we need to eliminate. But also, you know, Adrian was mentioning some of the community responses and the community resilience. There's an awful lot that we have. You know, we all have an awful lot of assets, skills, things that we can do for one another that doesn't rely on state funding, that can try and help one another and reduce some of that burden on what we know is a really difficult funding structure for the NHS and social care. So lots of things that we could do, but I think we need to look in the round, really. And certainly that split of funding across NHS and local authorities, because I think an awful lot of people don't necessarily realise the amount of social care that's funded through the NHS. So, you know, nursing homes and people with complex care needs in care homes and care and support at home, and understanding that whole infrastructure.
That's really interesting that you bring that up about that sort of link of health and social care funding. It's been something that I think Mark Drakeford, when he was health minister, it was something he was very keen on. It's trying to better integrate those budgets, really. Staying on the funding issue, Glyn, I'd like to ask, you know, you've spoken to, I've seen you speaking to the Daily Post, you know, about shortfalls in funding. I also understand that, you know, you've worked very hard to kind of protect your staff and even increase their pay at times during COVID-19 in recognition of, you know, the, all of the incredible work that they're doing. It'd be good to get a sense of whether or not the funding problems that you're seeing, are these recent problems? Are they COVID-related problems? Or are these things that have been going on, you know, for a number of years?
Well, even before COVID, I mean, the First Minister acknowledged the fact that social care was in a fragile state. And what you have to realise is most of the care homes in Wales, as I said before, are small family-run businesses designed around a family, homely type environment. And this is what makes them so special, really. There are a lot of lonely people living in their own homes, and it's sort of politically correct, if you like, to encourage them to stay in their own homes. But the number of times that we've had people move in and they've said to me, I wish I'd moved here a couple of years ago, because they do come to life in a new community with activities going on and they meet new friends, and it's amazing to see that. However, smaller size homes means that they don't have the scale of costs factor like most of the bigger corporates in England. In North Wales, for example, with local authorities only funding £576 a week or £80 a night, it means that occupancy has to be kept above 90% to remain a viable business. Now, we're fortunate, we've always had a waiting list to come into Gwyddfa. We've been able to operate in excess of 95% occupancy. But if we go a few beds down, we're not viable anymore. We're making a loss. Now, and on the other hand, you look at Cardiff, the other side of the country, and they're funded to £737 a week for exactly the same service provision, which I just can't get my head around. I mean, I was speaking to one of the bigger care providers in Wales with a few homes about his homes in North Wales just the other day. If he was to plonk one of his homes down into Cardiff in the Vale, he'd instantly be able to pay his staff 17% more in staff wages. And we have to remember that the care sector is now part of the foundation economy in Wales. Every pound that we put into our staff pockets is being pumped back into our local economies. Now, my opinion is we should be attracting high caliber individuals into the care sector. You know, youngsters, these youngsters are the future of social care. We need to show them that the care sector is a profession for life with a good pension to retire on at the end of it. And you're not going to do that by offering them £5 odd an hour apprentice rates. At Gwyddfa, we've signed up to the Real Living Wage Foundation. One of the things I learned very early in the forces is that you always look after the people watching your back. Our staff have been absolutely amazing. They've watched their back throughout this pandemic. The youngsters we've had come in have not thrown a single sickie. They've been absolutely amazing. Now, since we did, since we signed up for the Real Living Wage, we're seeing some highly educated youngsters applying for jobs. We've currently got three employees studying for a health and social care degree at Bangor University. Now, surely it makes sense to have these students working in a care setting while they're studying, rather than working for Aldi or Tesco's. But where are they going to go? You know, students need money to live on. It's obvious if they can get the Real Living Wage at Aldi, they're going to go for that. And who would blame them? The Welsh Government have made the Hardship Fund available, which has been a great help for local authorities to provide commission services. But self-funders have been left out of the loop, really. They haven't received any help at all. And I do get the impression sometimes that the Welsh Government perhaps want us to pass these costs on to the self-funders, which I just don't think is fair at all. The bottom line is we need to invest in our staff. They're brilliant, and if we can just start paying them a decent wage, I think that is the solution to solving the social care problem.
That's really interesting to hear, and it's, you know, it's a bit of a theme coming up, isn't it? You know, there's maybe been over time, really, people have had the wrong perceptions about social care work, and that's reflected in some of the pay, some of the conditions. Adrian, I'd like to ask your reflection, really. Do you think public opinion has changed about social care? Do you think there's a bit more respect for the profession now?
I mean, we certainly, I think, in social care all had a really nice feeling during the Clap for Carers campaign period, when it suddenly felt like we were being viewed as valuable as our NHS colleagues. Obviously, that campaign is no more, and potentially is, the public is losing its perception of that even as an issue. I mean, not everybody is closely involved in social care at this point in time, although they probably will be eventually. There are some sort of major issues that we need more than a clapping campaign to address. Absolutely, our frontline staff are doing work of incredible complexity and responsibility and sensitivity and patience. The skill level of much of their work is absolutely on a par with similar work being undertaken within the NHS on a significantly greater pay scale. So there's inequity there. I mean, what we've also got is a terrible growing problem where, you know, the national minimum wage is rising every year and has been for some years, but there's been no funding to enable frontline supervisors or their supervisors to have the same, you know, 5% uplift. So we've got, you know, incredibly hardworking, responsible frontline managers on like 50 pence an hour more than the people that they're supporting. You know, that's not going to do any favours to the sort of professional respect agenda. You know, there is like a sort of a hierarchy with the NHS at the top, then the statutory social services, you know, then potentially the third sector and or independents in this sort of completely unfair, inequitable span of pay levels. I think what we need more importantly, you know, than the integration of health and social care as some great big initiative, creating God knows what as a potential monopoly for the care sector. I think we need a significant bit of Welsh Government leadership, A, to find the money to address this imbalance for frontline and next tier workers, but also to establish a mechanism whereby pay is fair across Wales. Some sort of national bargaining or collective agreement arrangement is needed. I think that would do more to create an integrated of the social care sector than a lot of potential bureaucratic adjustment plans. And what also needs to go alongside it, and this picks up on Glyn's point about fees from one part of Wales being nothing like fees anywhere else, you know, there needs to be some national coherence and consistency about that as well. So we need a massive injection of funding, and as you mentioned, it probably needs taxation or a care levy or something like that, but it absolutely needs to happen if we're at all meaningful about wanting to value social care. That's then got to be translated into a mechanism whereby local authorities and the NHS are passing it on as a credible amount of funding for the providers to then pay equitable levels of the real living wage as a minimum plus differentials.
That's really interesting. I'm pleased in a way to see that some of the questions we've got coming in from the audience are actually addressing these same things. I'm gonna blend two of these questions if it's all right and put it to Maria actually. And then I'll pass it on to other members of the panel as well.
So we've got a question from Andrew Potts asking, is a national flat rate for the care element the way forward, potentially with accommodation costs being means tested? And similarly, a question from Pat Jones asking if the new normal is going to include collective bargaining within the sector in relation to paying conditions. So, you know, Adrian's mentioned a little bit about that as a potential way forward. Maria, I'd be interested to hear your reflections.
It's certainly something to look at. So the National Commissioning Board have a Tuscan Finnish group looking at trying to measure the costs of care and provide an evidence base for that. So working across the different types of social care provision, different providers, to start to build models for what would the cost of an older person's care home placement be if it was based on the real living wage and all of the uplifts that go through that. So we are trying to model that and to start to have an assessment of what the gap is. I mean, essentially it's a very sensitively political question, you know, that needs a conversation with the public. Adrian mentioned taxation. That's always a very, very difficult subject for people. On the one hand, we're advocating more wages, but then higher tax. And there's issues around self-funders, and that's a very emotive scenario there. But certainly, I think it's a really good place to start in our kind of consideration of the various different options. So what might it cost? So we're looking at scope to develop a clear framework of what a minimum cost of provision would be. I think that there is evidence that there isn't an average care provider, and land values differ significantly, you know, and so it's not straightforward. There are complexities to it, but if we can start with what the absolute minimum cost, taking all of the different elements into account, would be, it's certainly a place to start. As Adrian and a number of the panelists have mentioned, that to me personally, in my personal opinion, it doesn't make sense that if you're doing the same job, you know, in different sectors, that you don't have the same value, the same remuneration. So there's certainly something for us to look at there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that's going to be something I think that will be interesting to see in the context of next year's Welsh Parliament election, whether, you know, political parties really, really look at this agenda and try and take it forward. Just a quick change to go back to something else. And Adrian mentioned this kind of image of you've almost got a pyramid with these different services, and yet they're not all quite being valued the same, and they're not all quite working the same. And we mentioned as well how, you know, Mark Drakeford as health minister and now as first minister has been interested in this idea of better integrating health and social care. It'd be good to explore some of the sort of practicalities of that. So, Rachel, if I could come to you, I know that Flying Start is actually often talked about as a good example of integration of health social services. You've got health visitors. You've got local authority workers all kind of working as part of a team. From your experience, what do you think makes that work?
We're lucky enough to be in the same office with the health visitors. There's really good collaboration together with us. I think that's what anything really, you need good communication with everything. But yeah, that's what really works well with us. We work part of a team. We're all in meetings together. The referrals come from the health visitor side, and then, you know, we have good discussions with the health visitor. So it is really, really good communication and collaboration, and that's what works really well with us. We're lucky in the Flying Start project to have that good communication and collaboration.
And that kind of, that's a theme I'm hearing quite a lot from everyone, really, and possibly a lesson of COVID, is that, you know, there has been maybe much better collaboration, certainly better communication going on. Adrian, if just to kind of reflect on, you know, it's often talked about by people who maybe don't work in the sector, the idea of, like, you know, some sort of unified system, national health and social care service. Running a charitable cooperative, you know, rooted in communities, is there a risk you think that more integration would lead to a more centralized approach? Would it maybe stop you doing some of the things that you're doing?
I mean, it depends what that actually means. So you know, one way of interpreting let's have a national care service is that all aspects of care are absorbed back into the state, as it were, and we have, you know, one unified, almost like monopoly provider. I think there's a real risk in that being a vast bureaucracy in which, you know, local connections, local conversations, and the mobilization of different sort of assets, which we talked about earlier, could just get lost in a sort of a bit of a it's all down to us inward looking monopoly. I think, you know, adding to my anxieties about us going in that direction, it's sort of like what direction does it go? Do we pass all of reabsorb all of care services, including local authority responsibilities, into this Welsh NSS NHS thing, or do we try and decentralise and democratise the NHS so that it fits onto local government or regional footprints? I mean, both of them strike me as being really, really complicated and potentially could create more problems than they fix. You know, it's not perfect as it is now, but actually, when agencies do collaborate, and that includes collaboration across the sort of commissioner and provider boundary, amazing things happen. We ran a project in the Brecon area ourselves as the provider in partnership, really close partnership, almost like week to week meetings with the local authority housing department and social services, the social workers in particular, in order to free up our frontline staff to have conversations with the people they support about what really matters to them. And the amount of efficiency that we were able to drive into that system and the increased outcomes from that, just by being more collaborative and user-focused, was enormous. And I know Gwynedd is experimenting with a really similar approach to delivering home care in Gwynedd, you know, where the home care provider, you know, has got their desk in the same room as the local care managers, you know, and you know, the relevant NHS officers, so that there's instant picking up of needs and agreement about the way forward. I really don't think we all have to be in the same agency in order to get the benefits of real collaborative working.
Yeah, and that's, I guess that's another challenge potentially for the politicians, really, is to set out their stall as to what that means. You know, we do hear about this idea of integration, and really I think we need a lot more detail, something that we can properly scrutinise as to what is the vision. Glyn, I'd be interested in your reflections on this. You know, you've mentioned a bit about, you know, the communication and a bit of collaboration you've done with various agencies, really. How do you see integration of health and social care?
Well, I'm not sure that integration is the word we should be using, to be honest. I think we should be saying let's provide a seamless service, and it should be a seamless service to the service provider. The current system is just far too complicated for most people to understand. The funding issues around CHC, FNC, client contributions, third party top ups, who's funding what. And the poor service user is left to try and sort all this out without any real guidance of what, you know, what help is there. So whatever solution we come up with, it has to be a seamless one. It's going to be so complicated. I mean, as soon as you start using that, I mean, who's going to regulate this integrated service? At the moment, we've got Care Inspectorate Wales regulating social care. We've got Health Inspectorate Wales regulating nursing homes and the health sector. So it's not just a case of pooling budgets. And I know that that was a big thing a couple of years ago. You know, if we could pool the budgets, perhaps that might solve the problem. But there are other issues that we need to try and get over as well. And I'm just thankful I'm not up in the government trying to sort it out, to be honest with you, because I just don't know what the way forward is. My only way is to think we've got to make it seamless.
Just to go back to Rachel, if I could maybe ask you a little bit about that, because I know that that's part of the kind of flying start way of working, is it? Do you think that the people you work with really know or care about the differences between, you know, who works for NHS and who works for the council?
No, as families, they don't really know. They just see us as a project. So they don't, you know, that we work for the council and health visitors are under the National Health, you know, it's Cadwallader on our side. But yeah, no, they just see it as a whole project, as Flying Start. So, you know, they don't realise that we do work under different agencies, yeah, so.
There's lots of those little models, I think, to be exploring about. It's not, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be, as Adrian said as well, it doesn't have to always be about formal. It can be informal and collaboration and things like that.
Yeah.
Just looking at one of the questions that's come in, this is from Mary Wimbury, who's from Care Forum Wales, actually. So we've heard a bit about working with local authorities, and Mary said that some of the local authorities are operating in the way that Adrian was describing earlier, whereby, you know, increases in funding were actually done at the year start in a fairly efficient way, but others haven't. And she's asked, can we continue with a 22-way lottery in this? Adrian, any reflections on that?
Well, I would agree that that would not be a good idea. We should have consistency. I mean, there should be, you know, a protocol in place that if you're commissioning in a service, you have to pay in a timely way, and that includes ensuring that, you know, that new statutory obligations on the provider are funded promptly. Otherwise, you know, lots of care agencies are not cash rich, you know, bumping along, managing cash flow, and it's absolutely, you know, vital that they get that, you know, proper payment promptly.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's beyond just the discussion of social care. I think, you know, the local authority organisation in Wales is obviously a wider issue, and one that at IWA we've, you know, certainly taken an interest in the past and will continue to. Another question that's come in is quite an interesting one, and we've sort of touched on this a little, and I think this will be something again to follow as we go into the election next year. So Andrew Potts has drawn attention to recent Demos study, which is really interesting. I'd recommend anyone go and have a look at it. That is about tax, and they've done, you know, focus groups and things looking, including one in Wales where they've looked at people's attitudes towards tax. And as Andrew points out, it showed that there's not very much appetite in Wales for hypothecated social care tax or social care levy or a rise in national insurance payments. So he's asked, are we still reliant on the state paying a larger amount, and are the monies best found maybe from wider general taxation? Obviously, none of you are, you know, none of you are the Welsh Treasury, but I'd be interested in some reflections. Maria, do you have any views on that?
Certainly not an area of specialism of mine. I mean, we've talked about so many different things. We've talked about structural reform and you know, moving the deck chairs around. What this whole conversation for me has shown just the real complexity. But there's a big push around there needs to be more money in the system. So either the system needs to spend less on other areas of the system, or we need to generate more money, or we need to generate different ways of doing things. So build up some of that reciprocity to a community level, doing more for our neighbours and our families. So there is less demand, and or commissioning different models that prevent some of that demand on the system. So there's lots of different areas that we could look at it. But clearly, it really isn't straightforward. And there's a very real reason why I'm not a politician, because these are unbelievably difficult decisions. And all we can do is provide our, very best, in a collaborative, all in this together approach, very best evidence to try and support those that are making these decisions, have an evidence base for it.
Mm-hmm.
Tough one.
It's a very difficult one, and I would say it's not for the people we have on this panel today, really. This is a question that I think we will be putting to the political parties, and we would very much expect them to have answers to these questions, really. We've had another question come in, directed at Maria, but I'll go to Maria, but then I'll sort of open this up to everyone else as well, from Jonathan Morgan. He's asked, he said that he mentioned his new staff across social care have had a positive experience of technology during COVID with platforms such as Zoom. Do you think this experience will encourage an innovation culture within social care where technology, digital and beyond, is seen as an enabler to providing services across Wales?
I would really hope so. I mean, I think it's provided lots of opportunities, and it's but as I said earlier, it's not without its risks either. We have a significant amount of our population who just are not able to engage with technology. It just doesn't work for them. There are those that would like to but don't necessarily have the infrastructure. So there are quite a few people who are excluded from it. Mm-hmm. But I think it does provide us with huge opportunities, around really basic stuff around primary care, where some of our domiciliary care agencies can be going out and checking people's blood gas levels, as an indicator of the potential for the virus or whatever. So there's all kinds of things like that could really, really change our practice. So if a domiciliary care worker can do that, we're not having to send in a healthcare assistant or a nurse or a GP. So that's the way we can make our system more efficient. We've talked about real innovation in the workers using technology to support or continue to support family contact, where visits, or normal social contact hasn't been possible. So I think there's real opportunities that we need to build from, but we need to think about the infrastructure that underpins it and the fact that some people are excluded from it.
That's very interesting, yeah. I think Lynn wants to come in, but I'll just ask Rachel very quickly if it's all right. So have you found any issues with people? You say you've moved a lot online. Have all the families you work with been able to work with you online, or have you found issues where people maybe don't have
access? No, yes. There has been issues with families that haven't Wi-Fi, not being able to get access to Wi-Fi, not enough data on their phones, and not having the proper equipment to be able to do that. So that has been a little bit of a barrier with them. And we just support them over the phone then, but that has been a barrier with some of the families. So they're not being able to access the IT at the moment.
I think sadly we are running short on time. I think Glyn did want to come in. Apologies, Glyn. And we can pick this up at a later date, I'm sure. But that, I think, is an interesting one to reflect on. A lot of positive lessons coming out of COVID-19. But the it's often the issue in Wales. We really need to make sure that we get the infrastructure right with this. We can't just rely on technology being able to solve the problems. We do need to make sure that people can get access to it, so that all of those benefits can be spread around, really. Apologies to anyone if you have submitted questions and we haven't been able to get to them. Hopefully, we've covered off in the discussion most of what has come through there. I'd like to thank everyone on the panel for giving your time, giving your insight, your reflections, everything that you've learned, all of your accumulated knowledge and expertise that you've been able to share with us today. It really is a fundamentally important part of life in Wales, and we really, really need to be paying more attention to it. And that will be something that at the IWA we will be continuing with. And just to finish, as a quick plug for us, if you've enjoyed the session today, we can only do these kind of sessions because of the support we get from our members and our supporters. So if you'd like to become a supporter, on our website, iwa.wales, please join there. We will be keeping the chat open for a short period afterwards. The chat will all be recorded as well. So hopefully you've all taken something away from this today. I know that I certainly have. And it just leaves for me to say thank you very much to our audience, and thank you very much as well to our panelists. Thank you.